This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, April 27th, 2011.
Which is hard because there's a disorderly bunch. And the first item is approval of the minutes from April 13th. Are there any corrections, additions?
I was going to say, I don't know who E. Croton is. Other than that, everything's fine. In the first section under talking about the bylaws, there's some letters in the wrong order of my
life. Do the clerical staff...
Maybe there should be like an abbreviation for when I speak to make it.
EC.
Just under the bylaws, I think it's the first item of business. It's the very beginning of the paragraph.
Okay.
We could call him you again.
We number
everybody.
That's another way of doing it, but that'd be so complicated.
I move acceptance of the minutes.
Motion has been made to approve the minutes. Is there, and there's a second? All in favor? All opposed? I think they are unanimously approved. We then move on to item 3, our call for any late additions to the agenda. Hearing none, we will proceed then to what I think is kind of a tough issue, which is the Codes and Judicial Committee report. And I don't know how we should proceed with this. Ed, do you have a suggestion as to how...
Is there anybody that's prepared? Does anybody come with any kind of presentation?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of us here, I think.
Yeah.
I'm going to start by introducing, I'm the chair of the committee. And the current issue that we're facing is the new letter from the Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights, which is kind of has a new standard for interpreting Title IX regulations. University. There are people that are much more knowledgeable in this than me in the room, so I will defer to them to discuss, but I'm just going to brief you guys on the issue. But at the moment, the decision UA has to make is whether or not to approve a resolution to give the Executive Board of the University Assembly the right to approve a resolution which will pass in the next week or two, kind of make it hold before an upcoming case that is going in front of the University Hearing Board on May 10th. So it's very important we pass that. I encourage you all to pass that resolution. In the meantime, I'll explain why we haven't made a decision on it yet, because it's such a pending issue. I think either Kathy or Mary Beth can start, and then Ed Magruder can represent the other opinion.
Mary Beth, do you want to start?
Actually, Dan, if that's okay, because I'm not sure everybody can. Just to amend a little bit what Lee has asked for, I'm actually asking for something slightly different from what the resolution is. I'm asking for this body to today make an interim, take an interim measure to allow the campus judicial system to be able to operate according to the directives of this letter that we call the Dear Colleague Letter on the Office of Civil Rights, and I'll explain why in a minute. Before we do, though, I just wonder if we could introduce the people who are visitors so that you all know who's present in the room and who feels...
Yeah. Yes, let's do that. Why don't you start, Mary Beth?
So my name is Mary Beth Grant. I know many of you, but not all of you, and I work as a judicial administrator. I've been in this role almost 12 years. And I'm a visitor here.
Okay. Peggy?
I'm Peggy Beach, and I am Director of Campus Relations and have responsibility for the Office of the Assembly's Operations. I'm Liz Carr, I'm a senior lecturer in statistics and a lawyer, and in former life I prosecuted sexual assault cases.
I'm Kathy Doder, I work for the Chief of Police. I'm also on the Codes and Judicial Committee and have been in both Cornell Police and the Codes and Judicial Committee for double digits.
Very good.
I'm Sean Murphy. I'm a UA graduate student.
Excellent. Ari?
Ari Epstein, also with the Office of Assemblies.
Will Kandel, I'm an undergraduate in ILR.
Howard Howland, faculty of neurology and behavior emeritus.
Okay.
Christina Byers, staff and romance studies.
Mental Cell CIT, obviously HIPAA staff.
I'm Charlie Wolcott, neurobiology and behavior. I'm temporarily chair of this enterprise.
Ramsey Ataya, undergraduate, Iowa.
Edward Strong, graduate student in genetics.
Mike Walsh, graduate student in environmental engineering.
Bill Giorsi, faculty microbiology.
Many faculty. I'm happy to say that I've never had to know Mary Beth or Kathy professionally.
Leon Barnes, staff member, University of Illinois.
I'm Evan Cortez, grad student in music.
Okay. Amy?
Amy O'Donnell from the Austin Assembly. I'm John.
I'm Evan Brewer. I'm one of the judicial grad counselors at the university and ex officio on the CJC committee.
I'm Gleed Dropkoff. I'm an undergraduate junior in ILR, and I'm the chair of the Coastal Judicial Committee.
I'm Kyle Albert. I'm a graduate student in sociology, and I'm going to be one of the grad students at the assembly next year.
Mm-hmm. I'm Laura Weiss. I'm the director of the Women's Research Center at the DC.
Hi, I'm
Jeff
Rios. I'm one of the Chisholm Advisory Board at the Women's Research Center.
I'm Eva Drago. I'm a junior at ILR, and I'm also on the advisory board in the
future. I'm Holly Shear, and I'm a junior biology society major.
I'm a junior mentor, and I'm a junior at the bottom of the mission. Sorry to get off, and I'm just playing the
new Okay. Thank you.
So, we've already explained the dilemma that the university, I suppose, is in at this point. Universities and institutions all over the country received a letter from the OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, the Department of Education, a letter that's being referred to sometimes as the OCR letter or the Dear Colleague letter that lays out their interpretation of Title IX. Now, it's a big deal. It was released on Martin Luther King's anniversary of his assassination. It was Joe Biden had a small press conference, very emotional testimony at a location where there had been a lawsuit. It was announced at the same time that a lawsuit against Yale was announced for creating a sexual hostile environment. And it signaled the Obama administration's desire to, make sure that Title IX is being enforced properly. The way that the OCR letter is written, they're saying these are things that are already our expectations. And if you're not doing this, we don't consider you in compliance with the Title IX regulations. They're not setting out new regulations. They're making more clear their interpretation of the regulations. There's a difference of opinion on the CJC that's been going through the emails. We haven't had an opportunity to have a meeting. There's a difference of opinion about whether or not we need to follow the OCR letter. Based on the information that I've received from participation of members of my office with colleagues around the country who do judicial affairs, our interpretation is that, we do need to make sure that we get the code in compliance with the OCR letter, and counsel's office agrees with that position. I'm not here to ask you today to make all of the changes on a permanent basis that we believe we need to be changed. I'm asking you to take an interim measure to make sure that we can do our job today, tomorrow, for the rest of the semester at a hearing we're expecting to have on May 10th of a sexual assault case. If I walk into that hearing on May 10th and I get to say to the hearing board, here's the standard of proof that we need to prove our case by, I can't tell you right now what I would say. On the one hand, our code is telling me that we need to use a clear and convincing evidence standard. On the other hand, the OCR is telling me that's illegal. And if you do that, you're creating a disparate impact on women, and it's discriminatory, and you're violating civil rights law. It puts us in a rock, between a rock and a hard place.
Can you maybe clarify what the OCR is, rather than clear and convincing evidence, what is the OCR?
The two biggest changes, and I think, and folks will speak to this also, but I think the two biggest changes required by the OCR letter are the standard of proof and the ways that complainants can appeal. Currently, currently the code of conduct, our handbook code of conduct, requires a clear and convincing evidence standard, which is between the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt and the civil standard of preponderance of the evidence. The OCR is saying that for cases of sexual assault and sexual harassment, actually, I think what they say is any case that could be a Title IX case, but those in particular are identified, it needs to be the preponderance of the evidence standard. And the rationale that that they and others have used is that if you have an individual complainant and an individual as an accused person, why should one bear a bigger burden than the other? And that's the rationale. This suggestion, by the way, has been made independently by the folks at the Women's Resource Center. So that was already on the CJC's radar to have discussions about. Before that conversation was ever able to take place, in mid-April, the OPR letter. So what I'm asking, and I believe already everyone has seen the OPR letter and the memo that was.
This is the memo that went up by email yesterday.
So this outlines all the different places where our code is not consistent with the OPR letter. So my request to this body is to adopt the interim resolution that you don't have for you, that I would hope that somebody could make, say we will allow the campus judicial system to follow the OCR letter and, you know, in the different ways that are identified in this memo for, and you guys can figure out what period of time you want to give the CJC to get the issues sorted out to come to the more concrete proposal. Go through all of the things that they need to go through to make sure they're doing a reason and balance and a careful deliberation about it, but that we don't create a system right now where we can't take action on serious cases. And that you do that just on an interim level of the cases until that we can move forward. And in particular, the two that are the most important are the preponderance of the evidence and the having parallel appeal rights.
And having what?
Parallel appeal rights.
I'm just a little bit confused. Is there an alternative to us, accepting this, at least for the UA? Because it seems like the CJC is asking the UA to give the CJC permission to comply with federal law.
So there are differences of opinion from the CJC. So that's my request as the judicial administrator. There are members of the CJC who will present it viewpoint. And also, one thing I want to make clear, I in no way want to make it seem like the CJC has been lax or lazy or that they're not doing enough. These guys have been awesome getting interviews done for hearing board members, which is so important, and it's really curious. And gosh, I don't know how many days of interviews you all had.
5 hours.
Yeah, it was such fantastic work. So, I mean, it's a team of volunteers who have already been, burning the midnight oil, so to speak. So please understand that there's some really good reasons why they weren't able to have a meeting before today's meeting. But I asked Ari yesterday to put this on the agenda because I felt like it was irresponsible for me, as the director of the Office of the Judicial Administrator, to not call it to your attention at the last meeting that you're having this year. It just felt like, if we were to be sued tomorrow or next week by somebody who is dissatisfied with our process and we're not matching up with the requirements of the OCR letter, what would I tell them? Like, we have to wait because we didn't have time to meet. And then they said, but there was a meeting of PUA. Why didn't you just talk to them directly? I wouldn't have an answer. So that's why I didn't in any way want to make it seem like I was being critical of the CJC. It's a complicated issue. We do need time to talk and meet about it, but that's why I asked them to come today.
When was the OCR letter received?
April 4th.
April 4th.
Leon?
Yeah, I just want to say I have been following the Yale situation, and they're at risk of losing all federal money, and that's tuition and all research money. And Cornell would be in the same position. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars when you're looking at tuition and research.
So I think we need to take some action on this.
I just wanted to add really quickly that this actually, the CJC actually did meet after the letter had come out, and we had a discussion there when we did our presentation where we tried to get them to pass the changes with the OCR letter, and they refused to do that at that time. So we actually...
It wasn't so informed at that meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So but there we faced a lot of resistance. Yeah.
Howie?
Perhaps now we should hear the other side. I mean, just on the face of it, it looks like we got to obey the law, but if there's another side, let's hear it now. So.
Yeah.
No, I go right ahead. I'm mostly echoing what Terry does, so that's absolutely not true.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you all for hosting us. I'm Evan Magruder. I'm a third-year law student, and I'm with the Judicial Code Counselors. I think there are a couple problems here, and they're distinct. There's one, the problem of compliance with the OCR memo, which is really the fundamental issue. There's also the issue of what Mary Beth is asking for and how that relates to compliance with the OCR memo. You know, to be very clear, our office and Mary Beth's office don't see eye to eye all the time. We're a little bit of the public defenders. She's a little bit of the campus prosecutor. Maybe not quite that far, but that's the dynamic.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. My role isn't, those of you who've worked on the UA for a while know that my role has always been to try to identify issues with the system. But I am neither pro-accused nor pro-complainant because I feel that my role is to make sure that we're being fair to everyone. And it's a challenge because, I just want to make clear that that's what my role is. So thank you.
What Mary Beth has asked you for, if you read through this document, she's asked you for interim authority to make up the rules as she goes. She wants to be able to unilaterally lay down the rules to comply with what she thinks the OCR letter says. We strongly oppose that. When you go through the things she wants, and what I know Eva and others want is changes, these are the most fundamental possible changes we can make to the campus code, watering down the burden of proof to the lowest possible standard, which is the preponderance. Expanding jurisdiction, so anyone, potentially anyone in the world, can bring a JA complaint against a Cornell student, all right? These are the most fundamental due process rights that are afforded to accused students. I hear what Mr. Lawrence is saying, and there's absolutely an issue about whether or not we need to make standard proof, at least for sexual assault and sexual harassment cases, to comply with what OCR wants. There is disagreement on that question as a legal matter. Professor Claremont of the law school has asked me to bring that up. Frankly, I'm a third-year law student. I'm green as far as legal matters go, and I don't really want to get into arguing the legal merits of it. I think you'd be best off, frankly, asking university counsel directly what they think and what you should do. I will say, in terms of the protections we afford to these students, these are incredibly drastic measures. If you look through Mary Beth's proposal, she doesn't limit these changes to just Title IX sexual harassment cases. When she looks to change the language of the campus code, she wants to change it for everything. She wants all offenses to have a preponderance of the lowest possible standard. I think that's egregious. I would be ashamed to participate in a system of justice that created liability for criminal acts. A hearing board's finding of sexual harassment or sexual assault, that is a criminal act under the New York State Penal Code. We're going to put these kids in a position where they've been found with that violation, without fundamental due process rights, and then hang them out to dry. They're going to be convicted of that on a preponderance of the evidence. When the evidence is neither clear nor convincing and put in that situation, that can't possibly be the answer. I'm not an expert on the UA bylaws or the UA charter. I think something you also need to think about is this. The Board of Trustees has power to regulate conduct at Cornell. They've delegated that to the president, who's delegated that to you and the CJC. I'm not sure it's at all clear that you can actually delegate to an administrator like Mary Beth the power to create rules in the campus code. I'm not sure that's permissible. Finally, on a last note, this matter of the potential sexual assault hearing on May 10th, obviously we want to comply with the law. I want to comply with the law. If we need to comply with the law and we need to change the burden of proof for sexual assault and sexual harassment cases, so be it. I leave that under sound discretion. But the idea that we have this hearing coming up on May 10th and we have to go, 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 I actually just spoke to the student who's charged in that case. He's not under the impression that there is a hearing scheduled for May 10th. He's under the impression that a hearing spot has been held for him on May 10th if he wants it. I have no reason to believe at this time that he's actually going to elect to go to a hearing as opposed to the alternative, which is sign a summary decision agreement. So just to clarify that matter, it's not like we have a hearing coming up tomorrow and we may be violating Title IX as a result. I'll stop there. I know there'll be questions. I know this is terribly controversial, but I thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
I wanted to make one point of order. That proposal, that letter, came from the University Council's office, not the judicial administrator. So the University Council's position.
So as I understand this, I've got the language of the resolution in front of us that Ed wrote.
Sponsored.
Ed sponsored. That someone wrote. And this authorizes the executive committee of the university assembly to have effectively the authority that the whole body would have over the summer. As I understand it, the concern here is that changes would be made unilaterally by one individual or one office. That's a fair concern. We want to have oversight. That's why we have a CJC and why we have the university with the university assembly with authority over that. Does having, granted that we can't be in session over the summer, just having that as a given, I'm going to assume that nobody wants to meet over the summer, does delegating that authority on an interim basis to make temporary changes to the code, if necessary for compliance with Title IX, satisfy that burden?
Delegating to who?
Delegating the authority that this full body has, the University Assembly has, to its own executive board.
So maybe if I could just clarify. So the charter of the University Assembly gives in the time between semesters, gives the standardly as it is right now, gives the authority of the executive board to make decisions on behalf of the assembly in urgent need. And so really this motion is just reaffirming what's already in the charter, that the executive board on this issue, if urgent, could make a decision for the body and it says that it would be a temporary change.
That's all we're asking for, because this debate is meant to be at the CJC.
Yeah, exactly.
We just wanted to brief you guys on why we need more time. And so if you guys pass the resolution right now, then we'll give us more time to actually draft up a resolution for you, which hopefully will approve, the executive committee will approve.
Randy, I have a question. If the crime was or was not committed before this day, what standard of proof based on the fact that all the expectations up till this today is based on clear and convincing evidence? Is it fair to change the standard of proof between now and
when the crime is committed?
For everybody that's in the system, shouldn't they continue with the previous standard of proof?
It's a very good question. It's not one that I fully analyzed. It's one that I need to more carefully analyze. There's several different versions of the same question. The events that occurred, let's just pick January, the events that occurred in January and already in the system, the events that occurred in January and we've not yet received a complaint, the events that occurred in January and we won't get a complaint until September. So
I would separate those three from the ones that are already in your office and in process with the ones that aren't in process. And I think that's a fundamental distinction.
So I think if it were a voluntary change, I would agree with you, but this isn't a voluntary change. We've been out of compliance with the federal law. So it's not a question of, should we or shouldn't we? It's like we were wrong on how we were operating before, and we need to change it to what's right. Is there ample time for the person to prepare if they're coming to a hearing set up? Those are all questions I think that could be carefully weighed out. And as I pointed out, we don't know if anything's happening May 10th or not May 10th, but I can tell you there's lots of things in the hopper in my office. Waiting until the fall is not an option either. There could and should be some immediate actions on some of these things that might be coming up. And so that's the urgency. The urgency isn't to enact the memo approved by the University Council's office in full. The issue is to pick out what we know, as Ed actually said, for sexual violence. Ed did this resolution, sorry. E-words, they got me. As Evan was saying, the sexual violence and sexual harassment are where we're trying to get the interim measures done. We're not asking for the full memo to be enacted. We're not even considering that right now. We think that will probably come to the executive board of the summer because we do have an urgency to try to iron this stuff out. what we can't possibly do it in 3 days. But there are those sexual violence cases and sexual harassment cases that are either in process or getting close to process that are going to have to be looked at from a perspective of, and you can't really talk about, as Lee was saying, when the crime was committed, because that the crime may not have been brought to the attention of the system yet. It could have been brought to the attention of the system well in advance of when the hearing might, so there's plenty of ample time to prepare. And I think that if I'm trying to keep up on publications of other, like Yale's, and a few other people's decisions, a few other institutions' decisions on how they're going to act, they're just saying, off we go. If you are, in the middle of a hearing, literally, it would be understandable that you wouldn't, or if the hearing was the next day. But if you've got time to prepare, I think we would probably, in my opinion, I think we would probably be found to be out of compliance going on a faulty set of clear and convincing when we should have been.
Very bad.
The system is going to be with respect to both Ed and Evan's point. Evan, you raise a really fair point. I don't want to be in the position, frankly, of having to create a bunch of rules and regulations and then I don't want to be in that position. I know CJC has a meeting on Friday, so if this group feels comfortable saying, all right, let's get CJC moving as quickly as they can, I would at least have for the two very specific issues of burden of proof and appeal rights to be specifically proved on an interim basis, and only for the sexual assault cases. As Captain Hunter said, I intended for the interim measure to only apply to Title IX type cases, not for the whole code. I think that's an issue that we're going to have to try and figure out logistically, how we possibly have different standards of proof, but that's not something I would expect on an interim basis.
Nice. I think that it's worth just letting the CJC decide this before you guys make a decision. And I don't think any interim measures besides giving somebody approval today are reasonable.
Okay.
I was actually going to say something similar to that. My understanding, and I may be wrong, is that we have a meeting the same time next week. That'll be the first meeting of the new assembly. And that's, of course, the assembly that we're talking about. That'll be the executive board that we're talking about, the new executive board. That's correct. We have a meeting next Wednesday. Yeah. So we could, in theory, if given a resolution that had changes to the judicial code, vote on that next Wednesday.
A point of order about that. That is an organizational meeting. Assembly, which is not officially seated until June 1st.
Right. Okay. Right.
And the thinking behind this resolution is there's a provision in the charter for making decisions over the summer between semesters, but it doesn't specify exactly what between semesters means.
Right. Yeah.
So there was a feeling that for something this weighty, if we wanted to make sure that there was a group that very quickly on behalf of the UA could make the call, that they have explicit authority and that there's a document that says from this date to this date.
Right. I suppose what I want to clarify, at least in my mind, or make clear, if it's clear in my mind, is that after June 1st, we're talking about the executive of the new assembly, even though the body sits until August. Now, I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of this executive or the new executive, but my sense is that they would respect process, that they wouldn't be trying to make underhanded changes, that they would respect the authority of the CJC and its recommendations, and that this resolution just clarifies an existing authority.
That was the intention.
Okay. I suppose what I'm trying to say is I understand there's controversy about the code, and that's fair and reasonable, and we should have that debate. But in terms of what we need to deal with here right now, seems fairly straightforward to me.
And was there a comment? Ed?
I just wanted to say, I think we can all agree that the CJC is a good argumentative body, that there are opposed views on the CJC, and that's exactly, in my opinion, how these issues should be dealt with. And it's not at all clear to me what compliance with this letter would exactly mean. And I think that's exactly why we have a CJC to hash out these discussions. And so I'm leaning strongly towards letting the CJC hash out the discussion. Sounds like they're clearly a motivated group to talk about this. They're a well-meaning group, and hopefully they can come to us with the actual process and have a very, and do it in the way that it should be. It gains authorities input. It talks to council, it talks to the police department, it talks to people who know the law far better than I do, but it also will see some community input, I'm sure, because this bar standard really involves the community. So I would be more comfortable letting CJC run its process.
Liam?
I would be also, as long as the CJC also passes it by legal counsel, because if Cornell is sued, it's going to be legal counsel and not CJC dealing with the lawsuit. So as long as CJC passes it by legal counsel.
We have a meeting next week with the, which was put together by Kathy's office, with the University Council, teaching a webinar about how to interpret this exact document. So at that point, we'll be more educated on how to proceed.
Howie?
I'm sorry, but I'm stuck behind you all. But I'm looking at what I think is the document on page 5, section E. Schools must use preponderance of evidence of the preponderance of evidence standard.
Do I have the right one here?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. So, folks, this is crystal clear prose. It ends up saying, after a long argument, therefore, preponderance of evidence is the appropriate standard for investigating allegations of sexual harassment or violence. Now, I don't know how you can talk yourself out of that. I mean, if this is the government saying it, that's what ought to happen. Now, I don't want to get any. I mean, okay, please do.
I can counter that in two respects, not from my legal expertise, but just frankly, lacking. Professor Carlon strongly disputes that. If you read through the details of the memo, I can see why reasonable people would disagree. What I'm here to talk about is not so much whether or not we need to comply with that. What I'm here to stand for is exactly what's been said about letting the CJC debate this and figure it out. I suspect that at the end of the day, it's more likely than not that what this is saying and what you're saying will be implemented. What I'm focused on is, one, not getting to a situation where, where ends the reason, ends the rule, right? If Title IX demands this kind of compliance, so be it. I don't see why we need to water down the standard of proof for all offenses. Title IX certainly doesn't require that. Number two, I simply stand for the process by which we have a hearty debate with the CJC, we talk with the University Council, and we make sure we get this right instead of rushing through something that seems like an emergency, which in fact is not quite that.
We're in complete agreement, Devin, because I also think there needs to be a hearty debate at the CJC involving all the appropriate parties. My only concern is that between now and the conclusion of that debate, they can do our job. And Chair, we'll have to change you to lay ahead.
I'm sorry, I have a couple things.
Mr. Holland, and just to address your exact question, like this, Professor Claremont sent me an email asking to represent this opinion at this hearing, and he said that the question on my mind is not whether to comply. I'm in no way opposed to the OCR's outlook. The question for me is how to comply. And the bottom line is that amending the campus code would constitute a crude, ineffective, and destructive way to comply. He proposed an entirely different method, which is actually much more logically aligned with the OCR memo, which I won't go into detail.
Completely illogically aligned with the rest of the campus code. So that's what we're going to have our debate about. And I don't want that to put your name on the table here.
I think we need to keep.
What you said is actually far more accurate. There are pieces of this that is very clear, and with Tony Fairmont is going to defend my butt when the Title IX comes down, I will go with Kevin Fairmont. But the University Council has weighed in, and they've said under these specific circumstances, sexual harassment, sexual violence, we are out of compliance, we need to lower the standard of proof. And what we're asking for at this juncture, in this meeting, is to say, okay, in the hearings that may or may not come up as we move through this process, we're on notice now that we're out of compliance, let's act in compliance on these two issues, and then let the CJC debate the issues that are exactly what we're doing on the floor. There are some very frank areas on where this applies, and if you apply this standard to one part of the code, it does provide for some confusion on then what if you have to apply a different level of standard to different parts of the code.
I just want to say again, this is an important issue. I look forward to robust debate. but that, unfortunately, or fortunately, is not actually what we're discussing today, right? We're not, we don't have an amendment to the campus code in front of us. I would suggest that I would make a motion to close debate and move to a vote on this resolution to reaffirm the authority of the executive, to reaffirm the executive's existing authority.
Okay, we have a
this is a good debate. We should keep having it. That's just not what we're.
I just want to if somebody could just clarify exactly the content.
Content of the resolution.
You copied back there too.
I can move.
It's on the screen right now, right?
It basically says that the current charter doesn't specify when. Well, the current charter says during periods between semesters and during vacations, the executive committee shall be authorized to speak to the assembly on matters of policy, et cetera, et cetera. However, the charter doesn't specify what during periods between semesters means. This resolution says between April 27th, so that's after this meeting ends, and before August 24th, when the new body is seated, the executive board, which until the end of May would be the current executive and starting from June 1st would be the new executive, shall have the authority already delegated to it under the charter, which does not give it the ability to unilaterally change the campus code. It doesn't allow them to override the process. It doesn't mean that the debate isn't going to happen. It just says while this body isn't in session and can't review changes, the executive board will act on its behalf.
Okay. That motion has been placed on the floor. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, that motion is second. Is there any further discussion of the motion? Randy.
Yeah. If I would like to see in the finally resolved that any decision that's made has a sunset clause, for example, September 30th, that everything is tentative until that time. So for Texas University in case of a lawsuit.
That does not affect you. We're on notice. Yeah.
If the other things get passed, it's protected until CJC and
not. Our process cannot bog down the change of the sexual violence and sexual harassment being level proof being standard being level of proof standard being in order for Congress. Our process cannot delay that in action.
Oh, so no, it wouldn't delay it. It would just say. It is a preponderance of the evidence until September 30th when the CJC continues that for.
Okay,
excuse me, Ari has that.
Yeah, I haven't finished.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'd like that put in there, sunset clause. And secondly, I'd like to know who charged Ms. Fuller for the.
Yeah, my point of order though was that. Your first suggestion is in there already. There isn't a concrete date set because depending on the issue, it might not be possible to set the sunset date. But there, if you just want to rebuild the last two, be therefore resolved.
I do think there's a word missing that has to be the final result. To devise and full membership of the assembly.
Yeah, but I would put a date in there to ensure that the CJC has a chance to deliver it.
You know, I'm not seeing, Ari, what you're talking about, but I don't see in there anywhere where there's an interim adaptation of preponderance of evidence for sexual assault.
It says such changes should be as much as possible implemented on an interim basis.
So it's whatever changes the executive committee adopts with its authority would be made on an interim basis.
So we're going to just remain out of compliance?
No, that isn't what we said. Let's say that tomorrow we changed it to preponderance of evidence so that we're in compliance, and the executive approves that because this body is no longer in session. We can't not have it be preponderance of evidence. We're in violation of the law. I think the issue is that, and this is what Evan was saying, that if there are other changes in the campus code and somehow those are related to issues of interpretation, that we continue reviewing the code in the normal procedure, in the normal way. So we would never, I mean, we couldn't take out preponderance of evidence. We can't.
Right. I just want to make sure that I understand what this resolution does
today. So when we leave the room today, what will be our standard?
Okay, what this resolution
is not about that. The executive board has the authority to
act on it. What this resolution does, Mary Beth, is to simply give the executive committee of this body, of the university assembly, the ability to act on recommendations from the CJC, and to do so, and they will apply on an interim basis until the whole body can meet in the fall. And at that point, presumably the body could say a plague on all your houses, or it could say no, we like all the changes that have been made, but it simply gives clear authority to the UA executive committee to act. And I think the reason for this is that we very much want to have the CJC have the opportunity to discuss this and to consult with University Council, to consult with Professor Claremont, to come to us with a clear recommendation of what should be done. And I've heard various suggestions that they could come in two pieces. They could come with just the two pieces you suggested, Mary Beth, and bring that to us right away, relatively, if they agree on it. But I think it makes much more sense for them to debate this, to do the due diligence, to get something that rather than for us to craft it around the table here. And this then just gives the UA the ability to pass on that immediately by the executive committee, and is unambiguous that it has that authority. That's what it achieves.
And so my concern will be from today, from April 4th until that date of that executive committee.
Yes, it will be. But yeah. But
if you all accept that, then you're accepting remaining out of compliance for some period of time in the future. And
I don't think that's true.
No.
That's not
debatable.
It is debatable.
Okay, enough. There's a motion on the floor. Is there any further discussion of the motion?
I'd like to clarify this change in the code engine. Changes to the code. Are we talking about actually the executive committee now having the power to rewrite the code of conduct itself? Are we talking about granting the university an interim emergency temporary statement of compliance? What does this word change actually mean in terms of the documentation that's out there?
It seems to me what it means is that the Codes and Judicial Committee will meet and will offer some recommendations which will then be considered by the executive committee, which can pass them or not, as it deems appropriate.
And would that then be recognized as the official code of conduct?
It would, certainly for the time being, over the summer. Yes, it would have to be.
Until Sunday. And then it gets validated by the next formal full.
Right.
Well, in the same way that the campus code is always revised.
Yes.
Discussed.
Randy?
Ari, can you scroll up a little bit? Because I really take exception to a couple words. I'm down.
A little to the left.
Right. Oh, there are several parties. So who are the several parties? And I want to stop.
How about whereas the Office of University
Council? Right, who are the several parties?
The judicial administrator one. And the judicial committee, the chief of police.
Yeah, so I would either put that in, enumerate, or take that out, because I think several parties is not.
I believe that's a motion.
That's a motion. Is there a second to that motion?
Can you explain it again?
Oh, I just wanted several parties to be taken out. So I'm thinking right. Charles Manson.
I know.
Sure.
Or
identify.
You can just say the University Council's provisions are out of compliance, or it could say whomever these people are, but who are these people?
Okay. So we have a motion on the floor then to strike several parties. Is there a second to that motion? I was here a second. therefore the motion.
But he also did say, or identify who they are.
I know.
That would be the whereas clauses have no effect on the outcome of the resolution. I mean, I understand your point, but it is.
It's moot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no second, so we're back to the original motion. Howie?
Yeah, I'm going to vote against this motion because I'm convinced by the wording of this, which seems to be crystal clear, and the compromise that's already been offered, that we limit it to two things, sexual harassment and violence. I think we as a whole body should approve that now rather than giving it to a smaller group. So I'm going to vote against the motion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The motion, by the way, is to close debate and move to a vote.
Okay.
That's still the motion on the floor.
Can we do Howie's motion as some? I mean, mm-hmm. I agree with that. I would like to do that.
No, I think what we do is we have to vote on this, right, and then we can take up Howie's motion at that point. So is there further discussion on this motion? Yes.
I'm still concerned about the timing and clarity of this all in terms of the permanence of the executive committee's decision. And I guess what I would like to see is just, you know, some statement, be it therefore resolved that the assembly authorized the executive committee to approve changes to the code on its behalf as needed between April 17th and August 24th. And then when the UA meets again for the first time, they should have to approve those changes again.
I think that's problematic for two technical reasons. One is that the charter already gives the executive committee the authority to speak definitively on behalf of the assembly. Mm-hmm. And it has to answer for that in the fall, and if it overstepped its authority, I'm quite sure that it wouldn't get very far with that, with an assembly that it has to answer to. And the second point is, what would the status of the rules then be over the summer? Because, you know, projecting that second vote, the rules need to be definitively set.
I think they would be once the executive committee approves them. But then there's, you know, this kind of expiration date or confirmation date.
I think this is the concern that I'm hearing over here, is that there would be an expiration date on this sort of thing. I think that the changes, what am I trying to say? I think that we don't need to explicitly say the changes should be on an interim basis, because the University Assembly, the CJC, still has the authority to revise the campus code of conduct. We'll have that authority in September, October, November, regardless of whether the changes are implemented on an interim basis or not. We can't remove preponderance of evidence. That's illegal.
Okay. For information?
Yes.
The executive committee keeps being mentioned here. Will that change? Do we know who the new executive committee is?
Vote on them next week.
So those people won't even have heard this discussion.
Yeah.
No. Okay. I think we should end the discussion because we're going to have to talk about Howie's suggestion. And so, if there's no further urgent, I would call the question and ask, who is in favor of this motion? Please signify by raising your hand.
In favor of this motion. Of this resolution.
Who is in favor of this?
Sorry, can I say one more thing? Sorry.
What?
I just wanted to say one more thing, sorry. Does it make sense to vote on Howie's resolution first?
I don't think so.
I've said it twice now. The executive committee already has this authority. We don't need to pass this resolution. It's just clarifying it.
Yeah. All this is really doing is clarifying that the executive committee has this authority and the window by which it has that authority, April 27th to August 24th. This is already in the charter.
So, once again, all in favor of the motion signify by raising your hand. Okay, six in favor. Opposed? Okay, we got six opposed. And any abstentions?
Never seen that before.
Well, that is an interesting situation.
It falls on the chair.
I have not voted, and I think that in this case I will vote in favor of this motion. So that makes it 7-6. But I think the message is clear. Howie, do you want to propose a motion now that accomplishes what you recommend?
Yeah, I hope I can craft it, because I want to propose just what Mary Beth said. I move that help me.
That for sexual assault and sexual harassment on an interim basis, the standard of proof be preponderance of the evidence, and that all appeal rights granted to accused persons be granted to complainants. And you should set a sunset clause. But do it on an interim basis, effective immediately.
Okay.
Until the campus code can be adjusted to formally reflect. I mean, there's your sundown, and we actually adopt appropriate language properly into the code.
On an interim basis.
On an interim basis for sexual assault and sexual harassment cases, that the standard of proof be preponderance of evidence.
And that all rights of appeal.
And all rights of appeal afforded to the accused person to be generally afforded to the complainant.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let's put it.
I'm sorry. Yes. Hang on just a second.
I just wanted to clarify the issue of having, because currently, right now, complainants are committed to have care doing this. But that'll be resolved in your office.
Yeah. Because that's in the procedures and not in the code, so we'll be okay. So these are the two most critical ones.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just to clarify, if I respect Professor Howland's motion, and if the UI wants to do that, that's fine. You can't make this change on an interim basis. The code of conduct governs hearings. If you want this change, it has to be in the code of conduct. There is no interim creature that exists under our university procedure. I mean, this has to be a change to the code of conduct. You've got to make that change, and you've got to make it in full with no sunset clause, and it has to be approved by the president.
I was going to say effectively the same thing. What this, I would propose striking on an interim basis. This doesn't effectively say we will be in compliance with the law on an interim basis. I think it should just say we make this change, and the process to change the campus code continues as normal through the CJC, through the UA, whether over the summer under the authority of the executive or in the fall under the authority of the new UA.
And then if the CJC winds up coming up with a different interpretation or something, it should be changed back. Is that what you're saying, Evan?
I mean, all I'm saying is to have an effective change, a binding change on the hearing board that's binding and duly promulgated the university policy, it's going to have to be in the campus code.
Randy?
Well, I was going to say, can we have a second year resolve that, in order to kind of balance that and say that be resolved that we recommend the CJC?
No, because this is something the University Assembly is recommending to the President.
The CJC already has that authority, and they will continue to review the code.
Yeah.
Right. I'm trying to make an amendment to the resolution. Is that in order?
Sure.
I would propose striking on an interim basis.
Okay.
Be it resolved that in cases of sexual harassment.
Friendly amendment. Friendly amendment. Accepted.
Accepted.
This would put us in compliance with our interpretation of the OCR letter right now.
That's correct. Is there further discussion? Because we have about 4 more minutes.
Does anybody, the chair of the CJC or the...
Yeah, I'm just representing the opinions of voting members in the committee, of which the only people in this room are myself and Kathy Zoner. And everybody else's opinions that you've heard today are not voting members. They wouldn't have made these recommendations. You would have listened to them, but the vote wouldn't have counted as much as the other people on the committee, who are professors, students, and members of the Employee Assembly. This this change is just setting us in compliance with what the University Council has suggested. You're correct on that, Professor Allen. But at the same time, I have a letter that I've spoke from a law professor who feels very strongly on this issue that this change is not fit at this moment and that we need to discuss these changes before anything happens. And furthermore, I wanted to say that you guys are only considering the fact that the possibility that the university can get sued by a complainant. It can also be sued by an accused student if they feel that their rights aren't being preserved by the code of conduct.
Kathy?
I have two things. One is, it should say sexual violence, not sexual assault. So sexual assault is an actual definition, and it should say sexual violence, not sexual assault. And the other is, gone from my brain.
Well, I'll just say, with respect to lawsuits by accused students, absolutely, we can be sued by anyone. Our requirement is to follow our procedures. So if there's a procedure in place that you all have today, then the accused student, as long as we follow it, the accused student would have to say whether or not we're following our process. So
I came back with it. I have been in heated debate with Kevin Claremont over email, so I feel like I'm fairly versed in, it's not just Lee speaking for Kevin and me speaking for me, so I've been in conversation. My understanding of what Kevin is in opposition to is not the letter and the directive that we put forward here, but but attaching it to the code. He believes there's another process that may or may not work better, and that is the piece that will take time to peel apart. But right now, what we have are two places to handle this. When it comes to students, it is through the campus code. When it comes to employees, it's through directive policy and HR policy. So those are the places we have, rather than recreating, which we may end up doing after debate. This is the place where we have that we can bring into compliance. So that, and Kevin agrees with this statement that we need to be compliant. What he disagrees with, as I understand him, and I have been writing from him, is that he doesn't agree that the campus code should address these cases. He wants to look at the possibility of removing them and brought to another process.
Call the question. Well, I have a call the question.
Evan has could just say Mary Beth and I have some trouble over playing with Brent Duty. Can you please say what specific charges under the code this applies to? Instead of being ambiguous.
I don't think sexual violence and sexual harassment is that.
Section 1A and Section 1C.
Okay.
Absolutely, yes.
You're asking for emergency authority that, frankly,
yeah, go ahead. I mean, that's fine. But the only thing is that 1C also covers other types of harassment. It covers.
Okay.
So that part is
question's been called.
The question has been called. All right. Question's been called. All in favor of the
No,
we have to have an all in favor, isn't that what one does, Howie?
Yes. All in favor of voting, say, or raise your hand.
Yes, all in favor of voting, raise your hand.
If I may point of something or other. Did we figure out sections 1A and 1C? I see a look on.
I think it's complicated.
I can get that.
I know 1A is, I can't remember 1C.
We just look at it. 1C is
that was your concern.
Right, and it's my concern as well.
Just for
that this standard of evidence would apply to other cases not mentioned by the OCR.
It's just that 1C is broader than just that.
Right.
Sexual violence and sexual harassment is very clear. I think that's unambiguous.
Well, the attorneys might.
Well, we know about attorneys.
Okay. I think we've got to proceed.
We have
a motion on the floor to call the question. All in favor of that?
Calling the
question. Terminating debate. We have, I counted 7 in favor of that. Did I count right?
I think so.
That opposed to calling the question? 4. So we've called the question. Therefore, this motion is now on the floor, and all those in favor, raise your hand, please. 1, 2, 7 in favor. Opposed? 4 opposed. So the motion passes. I think that settles that for the time being.
One interpretation.
It's going to be a lot of work. I appreciate the university's attention to this. It is very needed, and you've got a lot of it. We're going to
roll up our sleeves and
work on it. Okay. Joe Lally is supposed to be here. At
give us a quorum from the hall.
Okay. Will somebody please ask him to step in?
We have a brief reset.
To open the
windows and
put them
up.
There's a projector right there. Ari will help you.
I have a presentation.
Joe?
I see I'm all warmed up on it.
Okay, will the group please come to order?
Oh, they can go out on a guy.
I need a gavel. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Would the conversations please cease and people sit down at the table? Order, order, order. Joe, you're on. I'm sorry for the delay.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Joe Lally. I work at Facilities Operations. While I'm new to transportation, as of about 14 months ago, I've been around Cornell 1984 as an employee and came here as a student in 1974. So I want to say I have a little history of parking. But what I want to do tonight is share with you, this is really, we're up to draft number 38. I'd say draft number one started with the Bain recommendations about a year or so, not quite a year ago. And share with you where we're at, how we got there, and what we're trying to do, and then see what things we have. So parking's always a fun topic. Nobody gets too excited about parking.
We can use something low-key.
That's really low-key after this last discussion that I heard. So hopefully everybody's blood pressure's going to, the possible kick in, and everybody's sort of mellow out here. So I'm here today to seek your input on proposed changes to parking and permit fee structure that we have set up. Transportation services does a lot more than just parking. We help manage the information booths and visitor information, collaborating with Techie Beaches Group. The big thing that we try to do is reduce the number of single occupancy vehicles. That's right. Been doing this for years under the leadership of my colleagues here, David Lee, Helen Stay, Amy Rice, and some of them. But we've been a leader long before sustainability got the popular or some presence getting down. And we offer a whole variety of programs, including emergency rides, a motor assist program, and emergency or special event traffic control. So when I got on the job, got the new assignment, I was sort of trying to get my arms around what it is we do, and I've been trying to establish some guiding principles that would help us get to where we want to go as a university. We manage a scarce resource for the university. Those are parking spaces in some places. And we see our job as recommending senior staff and trustees to approve the policies and the practices. Every year we have a policy
document that goes to the Board of Trustees each in September is renewed. But in particular, I've really gone on my way to try to engage the senior staff in the process of setting up the program and the rates and things like that. But really, all of my operations, we're trying to provide best value to Cornell and support the university mission. Current practices, these are not all of them, but I think some highlights, neighborhood parking. We have 278 lots at Cornell. It's a real challenge to try to manage that, but generally we try to have people for central permits to be able to park near where they work. We do give permit preference to faculty and senior administrative staff. A lot of people were shocked to hear that. It's a fairly common practice. We've been doing this for years, but it came up as an issue last fall, and I'm just trying to put everything out there that we're doing better or worse, and if there's a desire to change that, then there's a venue to bring that forward. We currently do not charge for handicap permits. There is a no-fee option for parking, and we offer financial incentives for carpooling and for use of public and alternative transit. So one of the goals that we're trying to do with this proposal is to simplify the parking system. I will confess it's so complicated I don't even understand it fully. We're trying to do the best we can to cover our costs. We don't totally do that. And we're trying to support the campus needs around accessibility for such things such as access and mobility, and in particular for things, initiatives involving facilities for zone maintenance and other initiatives that are going on campus, zone maintenance being one of them.
What is zone maintenance? I'm sorry.
Sure. Zone maintenance is the concept where we are no longer just having central stops, but we have the campus divided into four zones, I believe, and where there's a team of people who, if you will, are assigned to work that section of campus and provide a more efficient response, working a lot closer with the departments and to address needs of the departments as well as general facilities in the state. It was one of the main recommendations that came out of the facilities reserve process last spring. Other interesting thing is, not surprisingly, demand in many central campus parking lots outstrips supply. No surprise there. What's really come as a surprise is that in the last year and a half or so, we have excess capacity in mid-campus and perimeter areas, what I'm calling the campus and perimeter areas. And I don't know if you get through college now, but I remember 4 or 5 years ago that parking lots, parking spaces all around campus in College Town were full. They're now empty. There's fewer people with cars. And we have a very complicated system that customers can't understand. We also are in the midst of a project to replace something called TRIS, our Transportation Information System, 20-year-old mainframe system, and we just could not bring forward what we have. We have almost 640 permutations of permits right now. It's very difficult. This is one of my favorite signs. I have to stare at this sign. Well, actually, I parked there tonight and I had to stop. Fortunately, I had an interpreter along. They would have told me to park there. But,
you don't have a golden permit?
Hmm?
You don't have a golden permit? You can do whatever you want?
No, I do not. I'm not special. Although I'd love to tell you a little story. there's always that risk. So some fees have been held artificially low. We have some flexibility. We try to be flexible, but instead we find ourselves being inflexible, or it hampers other flexibility. So what we're proposing in the concept of a program is to reduce the number of permit tiers. We're going to go to 4 instead of 7. We're going to combine a lot of permit areas, eliminate some letter designations. Hopefully, people will find this to be a simplified fee structure with easy-to-understand privileges and hundreds of fewer permit types and subtypes. So, here's the need. We are going to maintain a no-fee parking option in ALOC. There's quite a bit of debate around that over the last year. We will maintain no-fee e-permit parking. This is where there's no public transit available. For Palm Road, Prince Shop, Schuyler House, and for the coming year, Africana Center, Sizer, East Hill Office Building, East Hill Plaza will remain e-permit lots, even though there are good public transportation options there. Africana Center, Sizer, East Hill Office Building, East Hill Plaza will become perimeter lots, which we're calling EH, effective July 1st, 2012, or almost 14 months from now, as you
proposal. We'll combine the mid-campus tier, three, tiers three and four, if they're known as mid-campus. And most of the lots that are currently signed as K, such as, actually there's two lots. One is the Morrison lot, and the other one is the DTI lot. Sit vacant most of the time, and their prices as mid-campus or tier three and tier three lots right now. We're going to make those perimeter lots at a much lower rate. It's a shame that people drive by those and they're empty. So see if that works. The Hoy Road garage will become a mid-campus lot, if you will, at a distinct rate for central campus, reduced permit types. We have a Y and a U permit. That will become a U permit. I don't know how many of you have been around here for 20, 30 years, but we used to have the old SMU permits, the hunting permits. I remember those as a student. H and F will become N permits. L becomes J. And the new Forest Home Garage, which is 250 space garage, which we expect to come online this summer, will be a J permit lot. And the decommissioning of the gravel lot between Plant Science and the Trillium will be timed so that this is available so people will not be without in the summer. So,
where is Elm? The
Toboggan Lodge area, and BB Hall.
And it used to be the two lot long lines of Andy Ford. They tore down buildings.
We will have a handout for you to talk about this at the end of this presentation. But first of all, outer lots such as the A lot and the E areas, which are I took it there before, remain no fee. Perimeter lots, we are proposing a 3.9% increase. Mid-campus lots, there's a variety of rates here. We have HH. And C. C is the area by the treatment center and the Shelcoff Crescent. We're actually going to lower those rates and increase the C lot rate, the HH rate by 5.4%, so those two match, and then they'll go forward. So believe it or not, we're proposing a price decrease for certain permits. A 5.6% increase for the garage. And we have a 5.6% increase for Z permits, which are assigned to certain staff who need to come on campus during the day. It also gives you flex parking. And for Central, we're proposing a 5.6% increase. This is your D, your J, your N, P, which is down by the law school, and then the U lots that I talked about. It's probably worth noting, too, that either sometime, probably early spring or fall of next year, when the CIS building site work begins, we will lose the lot by Foy Road. We have adequate parking in the garage, but the number of these spaces is going to go down quite a bit. We have not raised rates in 3 years. And so what I've done here is just to talk about our proposed increase of 5.6%. I'm trying to sort of benchmark that against the SIP pools over the last few years. Using 2008 as the base year from when we last raised rates. So they were 4.25%, then we had 0, then 2%, and looking at the 3% pool for the coming year. So while the 5.6 in the context of 1 year is pretty large, we think there's people have seen some senior staff use the word modest, but I think it's a reasonable increase in light of no increases over 3 years. And of course, people will like to pay that.
The people that get paid the less and drive in the furthest that might not be able to park in A lot, are there such people?
I'm not sure I understand that.
The people that get paid the least that have to maybe drive in the furthest and somehow.
My secretary worked through this in Binghamton.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to get lower than the 5%?
Well, if they park in the perimeter lots, first of all, they have the option of parking at A lot at no cost. That doesn't go away. That's still there. And so they'll have that option. The perimeter lots are available to them. and that's the one that has a 3.9%. I'm just playing the worst case scenario for the 5.6.
So SIP is a nice comparative, but this is not a merit raise for anything. And I think the parking fees are absolutely outlandish across campus. So if 5.6% is what you need to cover your costs for potholes and everything else that you do, that's a compelling argument for me to understand the finances of. But otherwise, it's like, not that I get a vote in the fees, but I think that what we pay already is $600 too high. And you know, not that parking should be free, but I mean, these are Cornell employees that, you know, like I would have to park quite a ways away to get to my J building, and I come and go at odd times, short notice meetings, you know. I need access to a vehicle. I'd love to be perfectly green and have a bike, but that's just not realistic in the way things are set up on a campus this large. And, you know, I don't get any incentive, you know, or bonus like $1,000 a year to cover parking, you know, for my department. So will you cover any part in here? What generates the amount of revenue you need for parking fees?
What's your cost and expense?
We're probably budgeted this year to lose $500,000.
That's what we're at. That's what I think we're at. So I'm not saying, I'm just not doubting you. I'm just saying, this percentage increase is good. Well, that's good, but what?
I understand. We're budgeted to lose $500,000. I will say that. So we're not covering, we're not trying to balance our budget on the backs of the employees. I will also say that one of the things that's happened, in part because of a lot of hard work on the part of staff with TCAP, is I think we have pretty good bus transportation. Every 15 minutes running between East Hill Plaza and North Campus, and it's, I think, a lot easier to get around campus than it was several years ago.
Here.
I would agree with that.
Please continue.
Okay. Yeah.
So, additional permit privileges. Central will be able to park in any mid-campus perimeter or outer lot as part of their privileges. Essentially, it's the trump card. Everything trumps down. So, mid-campus will be able to park in any outer or perimeter lot. This is a highly detailed map, and you'll get a copy of it. That is a draft as when we get done here, but I think in particular, one thing I want to point out, and my pointer is not working very well here, but for people who park in G, they will also be able to overflow into the C lot areas. And these are the former K lots here that we're saying will be perimeter lots where they currently were Tier 3. And they sit empty. It's just not a good thing. Here's an important point, and we've worked with HR Council. I've also been talking with Andrea Hammond-Lock, our ADA coordinator, but handicap permits will be eliminated. We're proposing that will be September 1st of 2011. Instead of parking in the general handicap spaces we have on campus will require an appropriate permit for the area that you're parking in. So if you want to park on Central Avenue, you're going to need, everyone will need a Central Avenue permit. I guess that would be a new permit. In addition, if you want to park in a handicap space, it will require a government-issued handicap placard. And they will probably be labeled at the request of disability services that they will start calling accessible parking, and that's an HP. I have down here an additional charge for reserve spots, but we're really trying to get away from the reserve spots because they're not utilized all the time and they take away from parking. What we hope to have is enough accessible parking permit spots to satisfy the demand. And we recognize that there will be hardship cases that we will need to consider, and at least I have a few volunteers from HR and disability services now that we'll have a review process. The one that's gotten a little press, or at least a little email, is the one that we were able to share with the Transportation Advisory Committee, and that's our proposal to have motorcycle permits go from a one-time fee of $61.56, that's with tax. By the way, we're quoting all of our prices now with tax, because that's the cost to you. So that's what our schedules include. To a one-time annual, fee, it'll be instead of one-third of the perimeter rate, and that's for all motorcycle permits, regardless of whether you park at Central Campus in the mid-lot or on a perimeter lot. And currently, for the coming year, with tax, that would be $115.64. MT permits are used by trade workers, such as CIT and other service workers. That's a rate increase of 5.6. Be subject to flex rules on Central lots. Z permit becomes a mid-campus permit, and we'll be working on spreading that rate increase over several years to dampen that impact. All special indicators are going to be eliminated. We have some 2,400, I think, issues right now. It's just a nightmare to try and manage and enforce. We will probably be creating some new permit types to address specific business needs. The one that we're most, or my example that I use right now, currently we have a Z permit, but if you have a USN indicator, you're allowed to essentially park anywhere on campus for up to 2 hours. And there are reasons for that. But again, in terms of that flexibility, these are the things that consume spaces that are in short demand. So we're trying to really understand the need for that. So we've been working with folks who use these to try to see if that will do the job. And we'll probably have to come up with a few more, but certainly not the 2,400 that we have this year right now. Rideshare program, we're proposing to eliminate the rideshare rebate. There'll still be a rideshare program, and in lieu of that, give you a reserve spot. There are a few people that get that. It's a real administrative headache to administer, so that's in our proposal. The student fee increases, student fee will increase by 5.6%. It's tied to the Hoyt Road garage rate, so for FY12, that would be $35.49, and they still have their transit privileges, which is they're allowed to ride TCAT for their first year at Cornell. We do, as I mentioned, have a new IT system that we hope to be fully operational by August of this year, replacing a 20-year-old natural database mainframe system. It's the second to the last system that would be on the mainframe once Koala goes live in July. So, and it has all the flexibilities that we currently get from all of our mainframe systems. So, some features of that, we're really looking forward to the notion of web-based self-service, working so that for initial enrollment at the onboarding center, the menu of options available to employees, that when they come to work at Cornell, be there, they can sign up there, sign up for payroll deductions, renewals will be handled online, appeals will be handled online, payments will be handled online, and every morning, depending upon the particular circumstance, we have a line of people at our door every morning at 7, getting a temporary permit because their car is being worked on, whatever. We think we're going to be able to allow you to do that online as well. So a lot more self-service. We're looking forward to that. Things will stay the same. Emergency ride. Not going to change that. So again, this is to encourage people to take alternative forms of transportation and not have to worry about, you know, when something comes up and they need to leave for whatever the reason is. It's an OT service. We do it. We probably do it about once a month, I've told, something like that. Family care support service. We have 3 books that we give, 1-day passes for perimeter and outer lots, so that people, if they need to come in, can do that. TCAT bus privileges. All Cornell employees can use their ID card at the fare box and ride around the city of Ithaca, including up and up to the airport. That's not changing. TCAT ridership is up quite a bit this year, 13%, something like that. Motorist assist program, that's anything from inflating a soft tire to jumping a dead battery, our own little version of AAA, if you will, calling a lock tank, whatever we need to do to help the person deal with things. So the communication plan, we began back in January with the latest series of iterations, working and getting some input from HR Council, things changed there. Got the opportunity to talk with senior staff in January for what I thought was going to be a 5-minute conversation and presentation. Ended up lasting an hour, right, Charlie?
I can imagine.
Very spirited debate. Subsequent debates that have been going on through the spring, which is one of the reasons it's now well into spring before I'm here before you. Just imagine having, you know, 12 or 13 bicycles and helping you design a parking plan. Now that we have the senior staff approval of the proposed plan, came right around the middle of April, April 14th, I think, while I was on vacation. We're trying to get out to constituents now, test this, see what the issues are. So we're here today. I wanted to get here today as the first public forum, and then I think I'm on the menu for employee assembly.
for the next week or so. We'll be back to HR Council in May and trying to identify other folks that we need to talk to. So we would expect that this will start July 1st, beginning of the new fiscal year. Existing HD and motorcycle permits honored until September 1st, 2011. As you sit back and look at this, you know, one of the things that might make sense to do is just honor existing motorcycle permits through the end of the year, through the end of the riding season, assuming that the change is implemented next year, for next year's riding season, if that recommendation survives this process. We're going to be deploying our new IT system. We expect to be fully operational August 1st, although we expect to go live, I think, on July 8th.
And
then now that the dramatic changes are out of the way, we would hope to be starting this process again right after we come back from holiday break in January of 2012. And as I mentioned before, the current proposal is we have a new perimeter lock, which is the Eastville area, and Africana on July 1st, 2012. And that's
Really brief. One is, transportation going to do anything about the bus that stops at the hotel store across from the Johnson, where it can't pull in? It's right on the road, and it backs up traffic. It's dangerous for pedestrians crossing the street.
Is it all buses or a particular bus?
No, it's all the buses that come in and stop.
You know where I'm talking about?
Yeah, we've talked about this attack before. I think David is perfect to respond to this.
David has the
answer. I mean, it's basically it amounts to this.
I'm not sure I'm perfect. I'm not sure, and I know the answer isn't perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. There would be a dramatic benefit to having a bus pull off on that side of the road. The geography of that particular portion of campus topography is particularly challenging and would be a very expensive project for which no funding has been identified. It is an identified need.
Okay. The other question is the new Milton building, the architecture, is there parking underneath there?
No, that the project for the garage was canceled. There is a surface lot that will have, I believe, about 50 spaces. It's that we'll be open, I guess we're calling it the city lot because we already have the University Avenue parking lot down by West Campus. So that will be open, we believe, in time for the fall semester, August 19th, to coincide with the opening of University Avenue.
In the same place behind, just smaller than it was before? Same place as the old lot?
Yeah, actually, I think it's going to, it's a 65, I think it's a 65 car lot.
Okay.
Right.
So is that immediately behind Sibley or someone else?
Well,
it's not where it was.
Okay.
And then what? No,
I just one second. It's 6 o'clock. We need a motion to extend the meeting. I would make such a motion that we extend the quarter after six. We still
all
have
in favor? Or extending?
Second.
Oh, yeah.
Second.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Thanks. One last question. Campus to campus. I got a. I don't know how many people went to, but there was a survey yesterday that went out asking about the campus to campus buses. Is that going to go up? Are you trying to put some data to determine what that's going to look like in the future?
We hired big red consultants from the Johnson School to look into the feasibility of a Washington service. Because there's been lots of demand over the years for air service and variety. So we have three students working on that. That survey was announced earlier this week. It has nothing to do with the parking.
No. Okay. But are you responsible for
yes.
that? Yes. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
So what is going to happen with campus to campus? What I'm saying is the New York City service is going to increase or is it going to stay the same?
We added,
that's just what.
All right. So we added 43% capacity, or more importantly, we added a New York origination that allows us to go from New York to back to Monday in the middle of January. And we see a tremendous increase in ridership. And also maintaining very good load factors. So that's working very well, and it's not broken, and we don't want to fix it.
So the price won't go down?
Actually, we're contemplating $2 price increase, but we don't have approval for that yet.
Christina?
I have two questions. Regarding the parking on Central, in the Central
mm-hmm.
permit,
If you ride share, will you be allowed to park in any of those that are within that tier? Like if somebody is you and someone is Jay, and that person's one that you're Jay.
You'll pick a permit.
You have to pick one or the other.
One or the other.
What happens if somebody's on vacation or is away for a month? Can you then get?
Give us a call. We'll work it out. We do that all the time.
Okay.
All right.
And then my other question.
So we want to ride share is important to us. We want to encourage multiple occupants in a vehicle.
Well, that's why I was curious why you were eliminating, you were reducing the fee. You're getting rid of the fee reduction for the ride share.
No.
Oh, you're not?
No.
There were some where if you had enough people in the car and you were coming up from Central Campus, we actually paid people to park.
Okay.
And that affected very few people, and it was a big administrative burden, difficult to track. That is the rebate that goes away. The dramatic discounts. So if you're parking on Central Campus and you have two people in the car, those two people will share two-thirds of the Central Campus rate. So they each end up paying a third of the Central Campus rate.
So the current proposal is to then give those who ride share a designated spot?
Yes. Okay.
For those groups that would have been large enough to get a rebate.
Okay, got it.
Okay, Steven?
This may not be the right forum for this, but feel free to correct me either if my information is wrong or if there's a better place to bring this up. My understanding is that there is such a thing as a short-term pass if a health issue should arise or something like that. Mm-hmm. You don't normally need to drive, but for a certain period of time, you broke your leg, you happen to be pregnant, say, and you need to drive to campus for a certain period of time, you can get a short-term pass. My understanding also is that there's a provision for reduced rates if you happen to have lower income, something like that. But that this policy can only happen if your if the cost of your payment, of your parking, is deducted from your paycheck. However, you can't, graduate students cannot have the cost of their parking deducted from their paycheck. So I wonder if there might be a form to raise that in.
Would you happen to meet with you, with whoever else you'd like to book, just focus on that particular issue.
Okay.
That's been fairly high level just because of the enormity of the change.
Oh, of course.
I'm happy to have a discussion about it, whether we can reach something, the intent is to try to have something work. Don't know if we'll satisfy your need, but I'll certainly have a discussion.
Certainly.
As far as special accommodations and people in temporary medical issues, again, we're pretty flexible about that.
Well, will that be affected by the handicap policy if you can't have both? Because there have been a lot of folks with temporary things, you know, broken leg. They had gotten permission to park in those kinds of spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't necessarily have a state permit.
I'm sorry, they would have
a state handicap permit for a temporary day.
They don't come from the state. Or government issue. Right.
They can break your leg.
Well, that's the point. You wouldn't have a government issue.
I think we will continue to accommodate temporary issues. I think where we're trying to go, I know where we're trying to go with the accessible permit is for the longer term situation. And where it's a documented condition, long term, and to be an employer that does its best to help people with it, you know, be accommodated.
Are there other questions, comments around the table?
Yes. Is the presentation available anywhere? And secondly, what's the best mode of communication to give feedback to you?
My staff tell me I'm crazy, but I'm jml2 at cornell.edu. Although a better mailbox might be transportation at cornell.edu. I get lots of email, and they may be able to respond to you sooner than I can.
But you don't have a specific census. Huge change is going into effect. You don't have a specific arena for handling such things. It's just to the normal channel.
Well, I'm coming here. I'm going to go to employee assembly next if they'll have me. We are planning a broader communication based in part on the reactions here tonight, and we will probably be getting this information out to folks. I would hope within the next week or so. Any other basic visceral reactions?
So you asked about the presentation. It's all in the handout.
Great.
Okay.
And
I guess one reaction I would have is you say that you're for reducing ridership, space use, basically. So if I had a car with seven people that could ride, that would be good. But you're actually discouraging the use of vehicles that could use less space on campus by having an increase in your motorcycle charges. And that is a fact. And people that ride motorcycles tend to, since they can't usually ride it all season, they have two permits. And they pay for two permits. So in that way, you're actually discouraging someone from using a third or less than a third of a parking space for over half the year. Just put that out there. That's really what, that's really what you're doing. So, just throw
so if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is if I ride a motorcycle and then the other part of the year I drive a car, your fear or your belief
fear.
You would be charged for two permits.
I am charged for two permits.
Okay. Let me digest that one.
I'm charged MEP and motorcycles are charged. If you drive a car, which you probably will in the wintertime, you will have an MEP or where you live, and then you will have a fee for your motorcycle.
May I have your name so we can
get this up?
Oh, I'm sorry.
NL85.
Okay, NL85. Thank you.
Very easy.
All right, so I appreciate that point, and let me go further. Yes.
Okay. Are there other comments around the table? Well, hearing none, Joe, thank you so much for coming and talking with us, and you know, good luck.
There's no reassurance. Okay. So if you have any particular comments about the handout or something that seems confusing or we need to clarify, this is somewhat of the basis. You know, it says draft, but we're. You'll notice it's put together with Scott Chase, but it's the kind of communication we're trying to plan broadly to campus. So thank you for attending the meeting and letting us know.
Thank you.
I would just like to say a word to the assembly, which is thank you. I think we've had a good and productive year. I think we've accomplished a lot, and it was because of everybody's goodwill and giving and taking. And as chair of this enterprise, I very much appreciate your good nature and support. Thank you and have a wonderful summer.
We still have one item to approve, the names of the, what's the term, hearing board.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
The name of the witness.
And Mike also had an item on the
Well,
we can do the hearing board in
I'm good to like that. So.
I'm not. No.
Everybody got the hearing board names, right?
Yes.
So,
I propose a motion. I'm not allowed to probably propose a motion, but I will anyway. That we approve that slate.
David.
I second the motion to approve that slate of names as the hearing board members.
Okay. All in favor? Raise your hand. Come here. I'm unanimous. Okay.
I stand with consent.
Done. Mike, I'm sorry. Maybe.
No problem. I guess I would just say maybe the executive should, we delegated a lot of authority to them today, we should
definitely
ensure that we have a smooth transition.
Yes.
Charlie, is this your last day as chairman?
Yes.
Well, then we want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we meet, the new members meet next Wednesday for organization. How many, just out of curiosity, how many people in this room will be here a week from now?
As a member.
Yes, that's wonderful.
A small and select group.
That's putting it politely.
The rest of us are going.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.